Hello, I'm Kate Jabot. Welcome to this special series from BFBS SITREP, The World in 2026. This time we get a different perspective on the year ahead for the UK's armed forces. They head into the new year with a new blueprint for a high-tech future from the Defence Review and promises of more money eventually. But they also have big demands on them already and the possibility of facing their biggest ask since the Falklands War. That's the assessment of Dom Nichols, who served for 23 years in the British Army and is now Associate Editor for Defence at The Telegraph.
I think it's been a turbulent year. I mean, the military has been very active, as it always is, but at what cost? Now, you say there's been an uptick in funding, but as most funding profiles are, that comes in many, many years' time. But if we take the Navy, for example, they've just had a very successful trip around the world off to the Indo-Pacific and back. But again, they could only do that carrier strike group, with huge support from allies and friends around the world. And so the question now is, how long would it take for the Royal Navy to be able to do something like that again if it had to put a carrier strike group at sea in harm's way tomorrow? Could it? Arguably not. How long would it take to regenerate? Has it got the ability to look after itself? The Royal Fleet Auxiliary at the moment, for example, is in a parlous state. So the Royal Navy, yeah, put on a great show, and I'm not denying that at all, but that was with allies and partners. And we like allies and partners, but is the Royal Navy ready to go again in a few months' time? In 2026, I'd be very sceptical if a carrier strike group could go to sea in an operational high-end capacity against Russia, for example, in months, if not over a year.
And looking ahead for the armed forces, supporting Ukraine remains the most immediate task. If there were ever to be some kind of peace or ceasefire deal in 2026, what do you think British forces might be called upon to do?
Well, I think they might be called upon to do arguably one of the toughest tasks they've ever done since the recapture of the Falkland Islands in 82. The military is there to deter, and if deterrence fails, then to win the war. If there's peace in Ukraine, then this deterrence force goes in, this coalition of the willing, whatever it's going to be called. It needs to deter Russia and reassure Ukraine, and the size of the army. And of course, it would be all services involved, but primarily the army as part of the land campaign. Yeah, the size of the army means what would it be able to put in the field on an enduring basis? Certainly not a division, almost certainly not a brigade. So a battalion, a battle group, probably. But I mean, how much of a deterrence and reassurance is one battle group? Admittedly, part of a much wider construct. But I think the armed forces, and the army in particular, through the lens of Ukraine, is about to be asked some very, very serious questions. And I don't know if they've got the answers.
Like what exactly?
Well, what is your armoured, what is your protective mobility fleet? We've seen the problems with Ajax. So what are you going to do? If you're on the ground, we're not expecting the coalition, the willing, let's use the shorthand, not expecting them to be over in the east, eyeball to eyeball with Russians across the demilitarized zone. But they've got to be able to react, and they've got to be able to provide a punch if need be. So how are they going to get there? How are they going to get quickly to an area where they need to operate? If it's a hub and spoke type operation, they'll be in a base somewhere in the centre or the west of the country. How do they quickly move to an area to push back in advance, or to say to the Russians, don't try something in the north or the south or the centre, because we are here. So it's getting there quickly. It's being able to look after yourself if it does actually come to a fight. And I don't think they've got the protective mobility at the moment. We've got about, what have we got, two tank regiments plus the reserve element. So not a huge amount of heavy metal. And when was it last rolled out on this kind of scale on an enduring basis? How long would it last until they start needing deep maintenance and really denuding the fleet?
And what about an RAF mission? Is that possible, deterrence from the skies?
Well, I think the RAF, if called upon to do anything, it would be the most likely task I see is to backfill any withdrawal of US support. Now, if Donald Trump decides to just walk away from Ukraine and pull the pin on supplies of materiel to Ukraine, but also, importantly, the intelligence support, would the RAF, with its space-based assets and the ISR, intelligence surveillance reconnaissance assets, such as the Rivet joint, would they be able to make up, or how much of the shortfall would the RAF be able to make up? And in concert with allies again, would that be enough to backfill an absence of US support? And it doesn't have to be total, of course. I mean, we're in the realm here of don't let excellent be the enemy of the very best. I mean, we're not going to be able to backfill US support completely, but would the RAF, in concert with allies, be able to put up a good enough force of ISR and space-based assets to continue the provision of intelligence to Ukraine?
Yeah, and looking forward to 2026, can you foresee anywhere else where Britain's armed forces might be asked to undertake operational work?
Well, I mean, we still have a commitment to Kosovo, still have a commitment to Cyprus. All these things are still there. I mean, they may only be down at company group size deployments, but, you know, it's a bold defense secretary and prime minister that turns around to the UN and NATO and says, we're not going to do those things anymore, or we can't do those things anymore. So there's an awful lot of activity that continues in the background. And some of these big exercises, the very big multinational, international exercises, I mean, they don't just happen. I mean, they take a huge amount of planning. So just carrying on with what is normal activity now for the armed forces is increasingly logistic heavy. And so just carrying on with what they're doing normally, let alone think about taking anything else on, and let alone trying to retain and recruit more people, build more ships. We've just lost HMS Lancaster without a replacement. So we're down to, I think, 8 frigates now, lowest since the end of the Cold War. I mean, lowest since time began, I think, since frigates began. So the numbers aren't great. Just trying to recover and build the force that we know we need just for steady state jogging is a task in hand, let alone what might be coming down the tracks in Ukraine and possibly elsewhere.
Indeed. And big picture now, what are the big challenges for the armed forces in 2026?
Well, the biggest picture is to decide what it's there for. I mean, if you see, it's like the Michael Howard, the great military historian, he said, you can't build a military to be right every time, to counter every possible threat. You'll bankrupt the treasury trying to cater for every single threat. The answer is to build a military force that is not so far wrong that when the threat reveals itself, you can't just quickly adjust a small bit of it and then face the threat head on. Well, we've got the threat now. Russia has presented the threat that we all sort of knew was there, and they've revealed themselves to be exactly as we thought and feared that they would be. So we know what the threat is now. The military can very easily build itself against that threat. It's whether or not they've got the capacity and the money and the political support to be able to build a credible fighting force to fight and win against the Russian army.
And what do you think, what is your sense of the mood at the top of the armed forces, the services, going into 2026?
Grim but resolute, I suppose. That might be a way of characterising it. I mean, I think they know what they need to do. I think they recognise the challenges. I mean, you look at Ajax for the army, for example, that's been a 20-year disaster. That needs sorting out. So the current leadership have inherited that problem. Whether or not they feel they're able to do anything about it is another question. But I think they know what they need to do. It used to be said that to get a seat at the table with the Americans, you needed three things. You needed a carrier strike group, you needed an expeditionary air wing from the air, and you needed an armored division. So full fat, heavy metal, tank-based armored division. And those three counters got you a voice at the table with the Americans. Now, notwithstanding the current state of play in NATO and how disconnected NATO might be and distracted the US possibly is, but if we just look at those three pretty basic measuring sticks, I think the armed forces come up short on all of them.
So when you're looking at the top of the services, what to your mind should be the goals?
Well, the goals should be to say with one clear voice to the political masters, what do you want from us? Do you want lots of exciting exercises around the world, reaching out, touching allies, getting on with each other, building that network? Or do you want to build a credible fighting force that can go to war tonight to deter a tier one enemy such as Russia and China? Because the two aren't necessarily diametrically opposed, but they are two. Starting from where we are at the moment in 2025 and the state of the forces right now, it takes a lot of effort to do both of those. And I think right now they have to pick one of them and decide which one it's going to be. Build alliances or build a credible fighting force.
Defence Explained. This is SITREP.